The Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129 presents America This Week, a smart Catholic take on faith and culture with Father Matt Malone and Kerry Weber.
Good day and welcome to the broadcast. I'm Father Matt Malone, Editor-in-Chief of America Magazine.
And I'm Kerry Weber, Executive Editor for America Magazine. Each week, we offer you the news and analysis from the intersection of the church and the world, gathered by our team at America Magazine.
And we are joined by one of our team here in the studio, Zach Davis, who is an associate editor. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Father Matt, Kerry.
And J.D. Long Garcia, our senior editor, joins us now to talk about this piece. J.D., how are you?
I'm doing just great. It's great to be with you.
Yeah. So tell our audience a little bit about this article, why you wrote it, and what it says.
Yeah, great. It starts out with the caravan and trying to find a place of common ground, if we can, to talk about the caravan. Kevin Clark, our chief correspondent, and I were talking about that during one of our huddles, and really trying to find a different voice or a middle voice. And in the middle of doing the reporting on it, this study came out from Syracuse University that they keep track of all sorts of federal agencies through the Freedom of Information Act, but the study found that the denial rates for asylum seekers was going up. There's many things that the study found, and we linked to it in the article at americamagazine.org. But the key thing that we focused in on was that the denial rates were going up, and that's in a way particularly alarming because we have more and more asylum seekers. There's more and more people that are coming to the United States to seek refuge, and so that's what we started focusing in on, and through the interviews, trying to talk about this caravan and the people in the caravan in a different way, in a less uniform way.
And are we talking about the rate of denials going up or the overall number? Because one would expect overall number, right? Yeah, right.
Yeah. So what Syracuse University found was that the judges are hearing a lot more cases. I mean, incredible. I think it's up 89% from 2016, you know, fiscal year 2016, which is, you know, that's nearly double the number of cases that are being heard. And then the denial rates are also going up. So the number's going up, but even within the number itself, the rates are going up.
Now, does that mean that these cases are not receiving the same amount of attention that they would have in previous years? I can't imagine you increase both the number and the rate of denial and suddenly give everybody extra attention.
Right, exactly. That's a great point, Kerry. And that's one of my sources. I mentioned that from one of our sources from Clinic that we're good partners with there, that the judges haven't gone up. The number of immigration judges that would make the ultimate decisions on these cases hasn't gone up. So in a way, it's circumventing the justice process or due process with the asylum cases, because there's this mandate to go faster and faster to deal with the backlog, so that it seems to be that the priority is to get through more cases as opposed to give people a just hearing of their case.
J.D., I wonder if it's helpful to just step back and talk about what the asylum process is like. Where does someone first encounter the U.S. Immigration system to claim asylum? Are they thinking about it before they reach the border? And then how long does it take to process?
Yeah. And what is asylum? What is it that they're actually seeking?
Yeah, that's great. Those are a lot of questions.
Right, and you have a minute. Right. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, oh, 1 minute. Okay, got it. It's a very good question, including the difference between an asylum seeker and a refugee. So a refugee would be somebody who was an asylum seeker but is now in a different country, is being protected. But I mean, we could go down back to 1951 with the UN Convention on Refugees. That sets out some principles of people who are being persecuted. So people who are being persecuted in their home countries have the opportunity to apply for asylum in another country. Usually the persecution has to do with race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or because of a political opinion. And again, this is in 1951. This is where it comes from, the United States. Then in 1980, with the Refugee Act, kind of formalizes that for us, and so it's part of U.S. law. And so the way that it goes, if I'm, say, I'm an asylum seeker and I'm being persecuted in my home country, and that means that my home country can't protect me, right?
Right.
So then I want to go to another country so I can have protection. So I can either apply for it in my home country, or I can show up in the country where I want to go to and ask for asylum there. Now, the UN doesn't really distinguish how you get to that other country. So you can, in the case of people crossing the border illegally, you could cross the border into the United States and ask for asylum that way, or you could go through a port of entry, and you know, you could walk through. In the case with from Mexico or Canada, otherwise you have to take a flight, right? And then you could ask in person, ask for your asylum case to be heard.
You on one point you made.
Yeah.
So you're saying that it doesn't matter the manner in which someone crosses into the country as to whether or not their asylum claim is legitimate.
That's exactly right. The Trump administration, a couple of weeks ago, it's hard to keep up with all the different activity, but I think it could have even been last week, the Trump administration attempted to change that, to say that if you're an asylum seeker, you have to do it through a port of entry. But a judge struck that down, so I'm sure that'll be debated. But as of today, it doesn't matter how you arrive into the United States as far as how your asylum claim will be heard.
The judge was basically saying, look, you're trying to change the law here unilaterally, and it's for Congress to change the law, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have these thousands of people who are coming toward the southern border, and they are traveling for often months at a time by foot, and they cross the border, and then they say, I'm here because I'm unsafe in my place of origin, and then they apply for asylum. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right. And so the first step that you have to pass is a credible fear.
Right.
So sort of a credible fear interview. So that will be oftentimes with a Border Patrol agent, immigration agent, not an actual judge. And then if after that interview, which could be up to 2 hours long, that agent will either pass you on to the next step where you would prepare your case before a judge. And that could take, a year and a half to 2 years to be heard. Or they'll say, no, sorry, you don't have a credible fear, and then send you back.
Right.
There's an earlier question that we didn't talk about, but on the border, some of these folks are waiting over 2 months even to have that first initial credible fear interview.
Right.
So that's what a lot of the folks in Tijuana are doing.
And that interview is really obviously very crucial, right? So how do the individuals seeking asylum prepare for that? Do they have some help? Do they have, are there ways that they can, clearly communicate what their fears are?
Yes, there's a clinic and there are other humanitarian groups that are providing counsel, free counsel to them in those cases, but there's so many in number that there are many asylum seekers that don't get the benefit of that kind of legal counsel. And the other facet there is that in June, Kevin wrote about this, but in June, the Trump administration said that gang violence and fear of domestic violence no longer counted as part of the credible fear part. So that's another thing that's kind of complicating our asylum process is what actually counts as, what counts as credible fear and what counts as persecution.
Right. And what we hear from the folks who are opposed to this process or who want the law changed to restrict these asylum applications is these people are faking it, or they are not really in danger, that they are coming to the U.S. because they want to game the system, or they want to live off the teat of the federal government, or they want to take our jobs. That basically these people who have up and left everything that they've ever known are doing it for their own selfish gain.
Right, and that seems to be very out of touch from the people that I speak with. If you look at the denial rate, so there's a 65% denial rate of that of asylum cases, but there's only, let me see if I can remember my numbers right, only 15% of folks make it to pass the credible fear test. So
that first interview.
So we're talking about like maybe 5% of people who are asking for asylum to actually get through. So if you can imagine, if you're well informed about it, which is an assumption in itself, let's just say that you're well informed asylum seeker. So I'm going to risk my life and travel thousands of miles for a 5% chance of getting in.
Right.
That seems like, I mean, that's a pretty risky way to game the system.
Right.
But what's more likely the case is that they have a little bit of information, or that they're just live in such fear that anything is better than this, and
right.
So I'm going to give it a shot. The other
that seems more probable.
Well, it sure does. When that's more consistent with the immigration attorneys that I've interviewed. That's been their experience as well.
Yeah.
Again, not from a political point of view, but just from reality. We're talking about a group of people, and of course, it's very difficult to talk about them in broad brushes. If you use a broad brush, you miss the detail, right? So, but the individuals are oftentimes coming from a lower level of education,
right?
So they wouldn't be informed, and frankly, I mean,
they might not even be illiterate,
like,
right?
Now, JD, many of the people coming, we've talked about a lot of the challenges they're facing, are women and children, right? So, it's a very particular risk that a family has to take to bring out their children on this journey as well, right? You know, we were talking before the break about, you know, maybe people are trying to kind of game the system, but it seems unlikely that people would risk their children's health and safety and lives for such things.
I think that that's right. In Central America, especially for young girls, we've been hearing for years about gangs and how they approach families and basically force young girls into gangs, and what that ends up meaning is that their lives are prostitution. So we also hear about, I've interviewed just young men who have been threatened, where the family members have been threatened, you know, if you don't join this gang, we're going to kill your mom, or we're going to kill your dad, whatever. And that's that kind of fear of death. You could understand why they would come because of that, sort of that push factor. It's very difficult to understand them coming for a less than 5% chance to receive asylum.
Yeah. And I wonder what exactly is the Catholic Church doing at the border, working with these folks, working with law enforcement? What is the unique contribution of the church in all of this?
Yeah, the church has been on the border for decades, and we've had humanitarian outreach there for decades, and my years reporting, I've gotten a chance to see how that's changed over the years, and we have in many cases we'll have with shelters that are set up for people who have been deported from the United States. And, you know, Mexico is a very big country. So if you're from southern Mexico, they don't bring you to southern Mexico. They just leave you on the border. So, and you don't know anybody there. You don't have any resources. So the Catholic shelters began, sprung up to help individuals that in that circumstance. Individuals also obviously are going north. And what the shelters have seen over the last, since 2014, about that there was a shift in the kind of immigrants, meaning starting in 2014, they started seeing a lot more Central Americans coming through as opposed to Mexicans. So that's one part. On the U.S. side, there's shelters that are set up. In El Paso, there's a number of shelters that are set up where they actually cooperate with ICE, so that if say a mother and her child are detained and released, the Annunciation House in El Paso has a lot of migrants that have been dropped off there by ICE. because they don't have room in their detention centers, or because they're in the process of being released on bond, or possibly with an ankle monitor. So the Church on the Border has a lot of direct aid for migrants that are in very difficult situations.
Now, you write in your piece that even before the current administration, previous presidents have put tough regulations into place on immigration. President Obama deported 2.5 million immigrants. So this is not the first time that we've struggled with this issue in our country. But one of your sources says that the Trump administration has put into place fairly significant changes and for deterring people to come, but aren't really doing anything to address the root causes. And this is a little bit of a change. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a notion, I think, among many Americans, people in the United States, and including the president, that the people are coming here to game the system, and so that there has to be like a deterrence. And there has to be kind of a threat of what will happen to you if you attempt to come to this country, and basically not make it easy to come to the United States. And so there's been, in October, Secretary Pompeo announced that our refugee numbers were going to go down to 30,000, for example. That's the lowest it's been in like four decades. So, so that would be one example. The Trump administration's been cutting off individuals who have temporary protected status, that's from different countries. And that's something that's illegal. Again, a legal immigrant that was here that was able to stay in the United States because their home country is experiencing natural disaster or just a lack of stability. And so that's another kind of illegal avenue that's been mm-hmm. cut out.
And what about foreign aid?
Foreign aid is also, foreign aid's going down. So our projection foreign aid for next year to the what we call the Northern Triangle, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, is going to be at least $180 million next year, which is a significant drop as well. So we're really not doing anything, or certainly not doing enough to help according to my sources, we're not doing enough to help people in their home countries, because if you think about it, you'd rather stay at home. I mean, it's a different language, it's a different culture, your family's around. That the ideal situation really is not to come to the United States.
You have to be pretty desperate. And so is that why the number has so dramatically increased, the number who are seeking asylum or coming to the southern border? Is it because the situation has gotten dramatically more desperate in their places of origin? Is it some sense that, you know, President Trump might be trying to shut down the southern border, and if we're going to go, we need to go now? Is it a combination of factors? Why the big increase?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. There's a lot of speculation about that. Certainly the circumstances and the situation in Central America is getting worse and worse and worse. And not to anticipate another question, but the United States had a role to play in that. So we were involved in the civil wars in Guatemala and El Salvador, and our involvement with the war in Nicaragua also had a negative impact on Honduras. And so the United States has played a role in destabilizing that region. The other thing just to point out is that Para Salvatrucha, MS-13, started in Los Angeles, and we deported them back to El Salvador. So,
and that's a gang, right?
That's a gang. Sorry,
organized crime
gang.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's in many ways more powerful than the government in Central America. So the situation continues to get worse and worse. And then as they have, you know, Central Americans have family members in the United States, so there's a desire to be united with their family as well. Mm-hmm. That's another factor. But it's hard to say. I've interviewed immigrants on the border, and I've asked, so, you know, what do you think about this being a deterrence? And frankly, I mean, they say like, well, I mean, I just spent 6 months detained, but I was safe.
Right.
And so even if they get caught, they're safer than they are at home.
Right. So we have about 2 minutes left. And what do we need to do about this?
Right. I think that the Carrie's question about doing something in these countries of origin is a really important one. I don't feel like that's really being discussed very much in the political landscape right now.
Right.
But that would be dealing with the push factor has to be a primary concern. But just the numbers in the meantime, like that's going to be a long-term solution.
Right.
One place of agreement would be that we need more immigration judges. We need more people to hear these cases. So there isn't this long backlog.
Is that a resources question? Or sort of do we need to just appoint more judges, or do we not have immigration judges?
Yes. All of those things.
All of the above. Right.
All of the above. And then the way that we, the United States, the Refugee Act really is a humanitarian effort. There's a humanitarian spirit to who we are as Americans, and that's being lost, particularly with this administration. So to return to that, and I think that's reflected in how we detain people, how the separation of families this summer as well. You know, what do we do with them, with these individuals that come to the United States, reflects on who we are as a country. So I think the changing how we receive them and how we, you know, to think that you come to apply for asylum and you end up incarcerated, that's hard to stomach. So there's a lot of those things need to be changed. But the long-term solution that most individuals that I've spoken with tell me is that we need to do something about these countries that in many ways we had played a role in destabilizing.
Right. That in a certain sense, we have to make them, we have to help to make them, the conditions in their countries of origin, a little less desperate so that they don't feel that they're fleeing a sinking ship or a house that's on fire. The piece is, As Immigration Denial Rates Increase, Asylum Seekers Face a Setback at the U.S. Border. It's by our senior editor, J.D. Long-Garcia. J.D., thanks so much for being with us, and thanks for your coverage of this issue.
Thank you very much.
And, of course, you can find that and all of our immigration coverage, which has been extensive in just the last couple of years, but I don't think there's probably not a month in the 109-year history of America Magazine that we haven't talked about immigration. So
and this is,
you
this
could
is
spend your life looking
issue,
at it.
one of the major issues of our time. I think if we look back on, in 50 years, if someone looks back on coverage of this topic and we don't have it, we've failed.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We had a screening of a new film at America Magazine last week called Hesburgh. It's about Father Ted Hesburgh, who was president of Notre Dame. Very active in the civil rights movement, very active in immigration reform. He helped to bring about the Immigration Reform Act of 1986. He brokered it between Democrats and Republicans. Ronald Reagan led the effort, assisted by George Bush, whom we were talking about at the top of the hour. The last time that this country and its two parties came together to deal with this issue in a very sensible and a very thoughtful, very compassionate way. It's still a model. So, we have the resources in our history to deal with this problem. All we need now is the will. You've been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. For all of the stories that we've been talking about and much more, check out americamagazine.org/Sirius. And to subscribe to America Magazine, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Zach Davis and Kerry Weber, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you. And good day.
You're listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.